I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Fresh off that rollicking celebration in the shadow of Abraham Lincoln, Barack Obama is shaping the final day of his pre-presidential life around another giant figure, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. The president-elect, who visited wounded soldiers at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center this morning, is leading a day of community service in honor of Dr. King. We're going to have more on that. But first, Here and Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff is standing in front of the Capitol on the Mall. Monica, at one end of the Mall is the Lincoln Memorial, where that concert was. At the other, the Capitol. In between yesterday were thousands of people. What's it like today?
Today there are more people, if you can believe it. Hundreds of thousands are already here checking it out. The bunting is up, and I'm standing in an area right now that I need a ticket and a lot of metal detector screening to get to. And I'm also being treated to Itzhak Perlman on the violin, Yo-Yo Ma on the cello. They're rehearsing for tomorrow's inauguration.
Well, I understand there are huge lines of people trying to get their tickets for all of this.
Yes, for those who went online and requested tickets from their congressmen, they were told to come by for an open house today and pick them up. But what nobody expected is the number of people. There are hundreds of people in lines that snake all around the Capitol buildings where the congressional offices are, with people waiting hours. I heard a story of somebody arriving at 5 a.m. to stand in line for 3 hours just to get their ticket to come tomorrow to stand in another line to get into this exclusive area for the inauguration.
Well, we understand the security is going to be intense. I mean, you know, I was reading up on the President Bush inaugural in 2004 after 9/11, when people in the parade, performers, were told not to look at the president as they went by him. What's it like in Washington today, you know, security-wise, as they're trying to get ready for tomorrow?
There are so many barriers around and fences. I'm trying to figure out where there will be free access, because everything looks like it's fenced off in some way and may require passing through a metal detector. And really, from the looks of the size of the crowd, that could be a huge problem, because there are so many people already here. And today you can move freely, so there's no problems. But tomorrow, when they start screening people, it's going to be very, very hectic and long, long lines.
We're hearing reports, too, that the cell phone companies are saying to people, please don't use your phones for calls tomorrow because the system might collapse. But I'm also thinking pictures. Everyone who has a cell phone is going to want to send a picture to someone.
Yeah, that takes up a lot of bandwidth, too. And I noticed during yesterday's Lincoln Memorial concert, my cell phone was cutting out. And I think that's a precursor to tomorrow, that everybody was probably doing what I was doing, you know, calling a friend or family member and saying, hey, listen to this.
Well, just remember tomorrow when we call you, Monica Brady Meyerhoff, you have to speak with us. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Take care. Well, it was always hoped that Martin Luther King Day would be tied to volunteering, and Barack Obama hopes to formalize that with his Renew America Together initiative. Both the Obama and Biden families are doing service projects in D.C. today. Michelle Obama is at RFK Stadium. We'll hear why. And Obama's transition team has created a website for people to find volunteer opportunities today or beyond. You can find that site at ours, here-now.org. Susan Ellis is president of Energize, a consulting firm, and author of By the People, A History of Volunteering in America. Susan, we understand that about 500,000 people volunteered on this day last year. Do you get a sense that with this initiative from Obama, there's more this year?
Well, it's a completely gut reaction, but I would say probably yes, because there's so much excitement about the inauguration, and it's this lovely coincidence of Martin Luther King Day coming just before the inauguration so that there could be all this attention paid
right
to it. We've had Martin Luther King as a day of service for a long time, but what Obama's done, which I'm really happy about, is he has made a real point of saying, do this today, but make a commitment to continue. No, don't just make it one day.
Well, but let's define volunteering, because President Kennedy famously called on Americans to ask what they can do for their country. He created the Peace Corps. But Peace Corps workers and VISTA volunteers, this is volunteers in service to America, they're paid. So, you know, how would you define volunteering?
Well, first, let me clarify something. There's money involved in full-time service, because both Peace Corps, VISTA, and AmeriCorps, which was started under Clinton, they provide enabling funds, as they call them, a living allowance, because all of those programs are full-time service. You're not permitted to take a job, a paying job, during that time. And volunteering, per se, one of the problems we have in talking about how many people do volunteering is how many words are used to describe it. A great example is, I always say to people, who dumped the tea in Boston Harbor? And they look at me, and I say, well, were they paid? Because activists, all the terms of activism, There's pro bono work. There are all kinds of terms out there. And the common denominator is somebody doing something above and beyond what they need to do for themselves or their families to help others, and where money is not the main factor.
So there are two different ways to volunteer. One's more national service, and people are hoping that Barack Obama enlarges AmeriCorps and other sort of partly paid organizations as part of his stimulus plan. But let's just focus on, you know, the kind of volunteering that people are being so creative about on this day. There's a huge effort at RFK Stadium where people are putting together 75,000 care packages to send to military troops. Another organization is giving a free walking tour of historic black sites. So tell us a little more about, you know, volunteerism. You know, it's just something the average person can do.
Well, there's plenty of things the average person can do, and actually you listed the two extremes, one being full-time service, which is enabled, the other being one day of service. And then in between those two are lots and lots of variations, because it does indeed include all the volunteer firefighters in the United States and volunteer emergency corps. It includes giving tours in museums. And it is interesting, I like to say that volunteering is so pervasive in the United States, it's invisible. We just don't even see it anymore. One of the beautiful things about a day like today as a single day of service is that for many people, it's an introduction to volunteering. Or, if you will, it's an audition of different organizations. I think that what people ought to do is start with, what am I interested in? And I absolutely guarantee that there's every cause you can think about. You can measure pollution in streams. You can be a weather watcher for the U.S. Weather Service and call in weather.
Is volunteering, though, just a way to not give adequate funding to things? I mean, traditionally, women volunteered in places that some thought they should be paid jobs.
There's always a danger that volunteers will be misused by those in charge, but the really important thing is that there are some things that volunteers are involved in that really, no matter how much money, we would still want volunteers involved. So that if you do a area cleanup, there are people who get paid to do cleanup and garbage collection and that sort of thing. But when a group of neighbors together beautifies their area, that area tends to stay far cleaner because people feel a sense of sweat equity about it.
Yeah. Susan Ellis, her consulting firm is Energize. She's also author of By the People, A History of Volunteering in America. Susan, thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, when Barack Obama takes the oath of office tomorrow, about 200 of the legendary Tuskegee Airmen will be in attendance. The World War II all-black force paved the way for desegregation in the military, but faced intense discrimination before, during, and after their service. Most of the airmen are elderly. They'll be chauffeured from the Bolling Air Force Base in D.C. to their seats right in front of the podium tomorrow. But joining us today, one of the airmen who will be there, Floyd Carter. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also on the line is Nancy Lieutenant Kalan. She was an Army nurse. Her brother was a Tuskegee Airman who died in action. She was the only woman to hold the post of president of the Tuskegee Airmen Association and was invited to the inauguration but had a little car accident and can't go. Nancy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Floyd Card, I want to start with you. In 2007, Barack Obama issued a statement. When the Tuskegee Airmen finally got their Congressional Gold Medal, he said his career wouldn't have been possible if it weren't for people like the Tuskegee Airmen. He called them heroes. He meant people like you. What's it been like to get this recognition?
It was a long time coming, but it was wonderful. It seemed like the government, this nation, finally realized what we had done for the country. And it was done under adverse conditions. We were subject to racial prejudice, all kinds of abuses, but we stuck to our guns. We came out to honor this country, to fight for this nation.
Well, in all, we know 994 pilots and about 15,000 ground personnel are collectively known as the Tuskegee Airmen, as we said, only a few hundred are still with us. And you trained at the segregated Tuskegee Army Airfield in Alabama. This was in the 40s.
You know, the most harrowing part about it is the War Department sent us to Tuskegee, Alabama, in the middle of the South, where Negro men were being lynched by the Ku Klux Klan and various other people, and no one was ever brought to justice. That's where they sent us to train. But we continued our training. We were segregated to the base, you know, afraid to go off.
Well, and this all happened because you were men who wanted to learn how to fly planes. And what were you told by the military?
You want to know what we were told by the War Department? They said we were not intelligent enough to fly military aircraft. They say we didn't have the coordination to fly military aircraft. Mm-hmm. And to add insult to injury, they stated that we couldn't even be taught to fly military airplanes. That's what the War Department stated. We trained under all white instructors. Now, some of those instructors were very fair, but many of them didn't want us to fly those planes. They did everything. They called us all kinds of names. And I'm going to tell you what they call. I was there.
Yeah.
They call you dumb nigger, black nigger, every insulting thing they could think of, some of those instructors, not all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to be able to accept that, because if you showed that you didn't appreciate it, you'd be sent back to the Army the next day. You had no place to go to say you were treated wrong. They'd just send you out the next day, right back to the Army.
Well, you know, a lot of people had a rough initiation into the military, but you were very clear. This was racism, and these white instructors did not want to have anything to do with you guys.
That's correct.
Right. Well, I want to just turn to Nancy for just a second. You sort of were having a parallel story at the same time. You wanted to be a nurse. And what were the young black women who wanted to be nurses and serve their country, what were they told about being nurses?
Well, now, I went to Lincoln School for Nurses in the Bronx in New York, and our superintendent of nurses was a white nurse. And in no uncertain terms, she told us that her requirements would be we would pick out the best white nurse that we knew, and we were to be 10 times better. If we weren't, she didn't care if it was the day of graduation, we would not graduate.
Well, it sounds like what she was telling you then was you're going to have to be better than me, 10 times better, because people are going to judge you.
Oh, yes. And we went through life that way. You have to be not good, but better.
Well, you eventually became the first black woman admitted to the regular Army Nurse Corps. Before that, African-American women could only be reservists. But then you had to travel around the country as an Army nurse. This is a segregated and, as Floyd was saying, violent United States. So when you were told to go to the Gunther Air Force Base outside of Montgomery, Alabama, you went. You went to Wichita Falls. You drove around the country to the bases doing your work. Did you understand the danger you were in?
No. I was really stupid. I had no idea. I just knew where I was going, when I was expected to be there, and I was there. You know, we were leading the way, and we knew that whatever we did, it would affect the nurses that followed us.
That's Nancy Lieutenant Kalan, the first black nurse admitted to the regular Army Corps. We're also speaking with Floyd Carter, one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. They'll both be back. Later today, former Governor Madeleine Cunin on the future of women in politics. Welcome back to our conversation with Nancy Lieutenant Cologne, the only woman to serve as president of the Tuskegee Airmen Organization. She was a nurse during World War II. Her brother, Sam Lieutenant, was a Tuskegee Airman who was shot down and killed during the war. Nancy was invited to tomorrow's inauguration but won't be able to attend because she had a little car accident. Floyd Carter, a former Tuskegee Airman, will be attending the inauguration tomorrow. And Floyd, you were telling us about the discrimination you faced. Some would say, why did you still want to serve in the face of that discrimination?
Me personally, I had said whatever they tried on me, I wouldn't blow up, I'd take it. And I said, if I succeed, I win. If I cannot take it, they win. This is the determination that I had.
I understand one of the things that happened to the Tuskegee Airmen like yourself is that when you went around the world, you were often taunted by people who said, why are you serving a country that discriminates against
you? That's correct. That is what they said. We were loyal to this nation. We felt that if you succeeded, it would prove something. It would prove that you were genuine and that you were loyal to this country. I wanted to prove we could do what they say we couldn't do.
Well, why were you loyal to this country, though? I mean, it's one thing to prove that you can fly a plane, but then to go risk your life is another. Why were you loyal to a country that wasn't loyal to you?
It was our country, and we had to do our share to keep it that way.
That was Nancy Lieutenant Kahlon speaking. Floyd, what drove you?
I felt that what I wanted to prove, that I could do anything that any other man can do. And I was determined to succeed. And that is what I did. Let me run this by you right quick.
Yeah.
They say we didn't have the intelligence. They say we didn't have the coordination. They say we couldn't even be taught. Well, eventually, I went through all of this. I succeeded. Fly planes. I was appointed the first black commander of a four-engine jet squadron at McGuire Air Force Base in the history of this nation. How is that for intelligence? I'm a command pilot. That's as high as you can go. You go beyond the command pilots, you are an astronaut. So I'm a command pilot. I'm an instructor pilot. Then I was made commander of this McGuire Air Force Base four-jet squadron, four-engine jets, the most modern that they had in the Air Force. Guess what? I was the only black officer in the squadron, and I was the commander. Every officer was white. Only one officer was black, and that was Floyd J. Carter. And I commanded that squadron for 4 years. From 1970 to 1974, until I retired. When I took over the squadron, it was rated number 3 in the wing. When I retired in 1974, it was rated number 1.
And not only that, the work of the Tuskegee Airmen, and we note again that Nancy was the first black woman admitted to the regular Army Nurse Corps, led to the desegregation of the military. Did you know, Floyd Carter, that what you were going to do might change the world? And did you ever think that it was going to change as much as you're about to see?
I never thought we would have a black president in this country at this time. I never thought it would happen in my lifetime. I'm surprised at that, but pleasantly surprised. I can't wait to get to Washington to shake his hand.
I certainly wish that I would be able to attend, but it really is a historical event that I would not believe I would be alive to witness this. It's wonderful.
Nancy Lieutenant Kahlon was an Army nurse during World War II. She's a former president of the Tuskegee Airmen Organization. Her brother was shot down during combat. Floyd Carter was one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. He will be attending the inauguration of Barack Obama. I want to thank you both for speaking to us. And
can I say one more thing?
Oh, please.
My life duty is now I speak to young Negro children at schools, public schools, private schools, colleges, and I encourage them to study hard, learn as much as you can, and to believe in God. And all things can be accomplished.
You know, that is a lovely thought, and we thank you for that. I'm wondering, though, both of you, Floyd and Nancy, I seem to have heard from both of you is that you both had to be better than everybody else.
Oh, yes.
Do you think that's still true of young black people today?
I think so. I don't think the youth of today has in mind the things that we had when we were their age. We were far ahead of them in thinking. They are going to have to work pretty hard to be able to give freely like we gave freely.
I feel that if they exceed in science and technology, believe in God, and all things are possible. Thank you.
Well, I want to wish you both a remarkable day tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you for speaking with us.
And thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
God bless.
A quick note. Yesterday's concert at the foot of the Lincoln Memorial is getting raves, and one song jumped out at us.
This land was made for you and me.
Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land, performed by Pete Seeger, Bruce Springsteen, and thousands on the Mall, who didn't know all the words, but that's because some of those words were considered too radical to record during the McCarthy era. Woody Guthrie wrote the lyrics in 1940 in response to Irving Berlin's God Bless America, which he felt didn't paint the full picture of a country mired in depression. Well, here's the verse Guthrie never recorded. It might resonate today for Americans mired in a recession.
By the shadow of the steeple,
by the shadow of the steeple,
by the relief office,
I saw my people.
And, of course, we'll have coverage of the inauguration for you tomorrow, here and now.
On the other side, the king say nothing.
Change is in the air with the inauguration of a new president tomorrow. Of course, some were hoping for a different kind of change, among them Madeleine Cunin, who made history herself when she was elected governor of Vermont in 1985, becoming that state's first woman and first Jewish governor. She was one of many who hoped to see the first female president. She now supports Barack Obama. But we wondered, what does she think about the future of women in politics? Cunin went on to serve as ambassador to Switzerland during the Clinton administration. She's the author of a new book, a call to action, really, for new female political leadership. The book is Pearls, Politics and Power, How Women Can Win and Lead. She's currently a professor at the University of Vermont. Governor Cunin, at the heart of your book is the question, why don't more women run for office? What was your answer?
Well, I think there are a couple of things at work. One is that politics is such a bad reputation. You know, we all know the downsides, you know, that you're vulnerable, that it's dirty, that there's lying. So we forget that that's where the action really is. That's where that $100 million gets appropriated. And the only way it gets appropriated, if you sit at the table or in the chamber and cast a vote. So we have to encourage more women to recognize that that's where the ultimate power resides. We also have to seek them out. You know, we have to recruit them and then support them, not just financially, though that's very important. You know, more women, especially with young children, have a lot of juggling to do, to do this 24/7 job and also take care of their families. You know, one young woman I spoke to, her friends organized a whole team that brought hot cooked dinners to her family three nights a week when she was running and even afterwards, or they volunteered to drive her kids. Women also feel they have to know everything. You know, a man will say, I think I could run for the United States Senate. And a woman will say, well, before I run for anything, I've got to take three more courses. You know, Kathleen Sebelius gave me a great quote, the governor of Kansas. She said, any woman who's organized a birthday party for a five-year-old can organize a campaign. And there's some truth in that.
Well, meanwhile, there were some big wins for women. I'm looking at New Hampshire, the results in New Hampshire. They voted into office a majority female Senate. It's the first time any state in the country has elected a legislative chamber in which women outnumber men. Mm-hmm. Is that something in New Hampshire that surprised you, or are you seeing behind that statistic a lot of work to get women into position to even run?
Well, interestingly enough, 2 years ago, I spoke at a fundraiser for Democratic candidates for the New Hampshire Senate, and they were outstanding women. They went out and recruited these women who had been successful in their own fields in the private sector, and I was very impressed at the time. So I think it does show it does take work. It does take recruiting. The top three states in the percentages of women in their legislatures are Colorado at 38%, Vermont at 37.8%, and New Hampshire at 37.7%. So we're all hovering in the same area. I can't speak for Colorado, but both Vermont and New Hampshire have part-time citizen legislatures. And I think that's still easier for women to manage. and both New Hampshire and Vermont have had women speakers of the House. And my simple theory is the more you see, the more you get. The more common it is for women to be out there at the podium wielding the gavel, the less of a can a woman do this question there is.
Well, you write in your book about one recurring number that was recurring for a long time. It was 16%, and it was stuck on 16%. Explain that number.
Well, that 16% figure was the figure that was accurate on November 3rd for the percentage of women in the United States Congress. And on November 4th, it crawled up to 17%, which shows you the pace at which change is taking place. But it also occurred in the corporate world, where women in top corporate positions comprise 16%. And then, of course, 16% is the average figure of women in houses of parliament, where we rank 69th.
That's amazing that same number, again, yes, it's etched up to 17 in Congress, but that pretty much 16% across the board, or boards, if you will, of women involved in everything, corporations, parliaments, Congress.
It shows you that we're stuck and that we can't just assume that gradual change is going to lead to equality. It means we have to really recruit women, encourage women. And the reason is because the agenda changes when women are in power. I mean, issues like violence against women. You know, family violence was considered a private matter until women got into power and women became activists outside of the political system. Rape crisis centers didn't exist. There was no research on breast cancer till women got involved. And I suspect that if there were more women in the United States Congress today, we would have laws like paid family leave, and we would have children's health insurance, because women are just closer to that issue, because they are often the person in the family who takes the children to the doctor, who is responsible for taking care of an elderly parent. So they know these issues up close, and they care intensely about them. And intensity makes a difference in what gets done.
Well, and we just want to make note of one last thing. You also write in your book about how women run for office out of necessity when they see no other choice for the future of their children. And you came to that conclusion after you met with a Rwandan woman parliamentarian. What happened in the Rwandan parliamentary after the genocide?
Well, this is entirely counterintuitive. The number one state in the world in the percentage of women in its lower house of parliament is Rwanda. Well, I called a senator from Rwanda and asked her what was going on. And she said, well, after the genocide, one, the women demanded a quota of 30%. They exceeded it. They got to 48.8%. And then they decided they weren't going to leave politics just to the men. They went back in their communities. They built schools. They united families. And when I asked this woman again, tell me really what's going on, she said, we knew we had to do this to get involved in politics for the survival of our children. And my conclusion was, we in the United States of America have to do this, to be political, to run for office, to ask other women to run for the survival of our children and children all over the world.
That's Madeleine Cunin, former governor of Vermont and former ambassador during the Clinton administration. Her new book is Pearls, Politics and Power, How Women Can Win and Lead. Governor, Ambassador Cunin, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a delight.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, presidents may come and go, but for almost 60 years, veteran reporter Helen Thomas has stayed asking questions like this one of President Bush.
Your decision to invade Iraq has caused the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis, wounds of Americans and Iraqis for a lifetime. Every reason given, publicly at least, has turned out not to be true. My question is, why did you really want to go to war? Mm-hmm. From the moment you stepped into the White House, yeah. From your cabinet, former cabinet officers, intelligence people, and so forth. Mm-hmm. What was your real reason? You have said it wasn't oil, quest for oil. It hasn't been Israel or anything else. What was it?
Well, President Bush denied her premise that he wanted to go to war. Thomas is a columnist now for the Hearst newspaper chain, not a Wire reporter, and Bush didn't even call on her in his last conference. She says he knew she'd ask about Gaza. But now Barack Obama will face her questions. Helen Thomas, what do you want to ask the new president?
Well, of course, I want to know how we can get out of these wars and stop the killing. If he says 16 months, I say that it should be yesterday, tomorrow. And, of course, the economic collapse is the biggest thing on his plate, and that's probably right. But I think we ought to stop massive killing, which we're doing.
Well, in your column, you asked the president-elect to reconcile his earlier stance that he would pull U.S. troops out of Iraq in 16 months with his later stance that he would listen to commanders on the ground.
Now, that's the biggest dodge. You know, this is Bush 3.
Well, you also asked, does a good speech make a good president? You say his record on opposing the war wasn't what it seemed. You give the lie to the notion that this is a left-leaning, sycophantic press.
I don't think it's left at all. I don't think it's liberal at all. And I don't think they're thinking things through if they keep us in the status quo of violence.
What other questions do you have for Barack Obama?
Why doesn't he go for a single-payer health plan where everybody, like Social Security, contributes from the day they're born, practically, so that everyone will have some health care?
Is this the Helen Thomas that's a columnist who brings more of her opinion into her questions, or do you think this was always how you approached your questioning?
I have the right to express my opinion. I write a column that's an opinion column. I wrote for 57 years for a wire service where I walk right down the middle. But I did not bow out of the human race. I permitted myself to think, to care, to believe.
You were very skeptical of Barack Obama overall in your column. You said Martin Luther King had a dream too, but he acted on it. He marched. He went to jail. You know, I'm just wondering, Helen Thomas, you already are ready to hold the new president's feet to the fire, but some of your aggressiveness at the end of the Bush administration meant you didn't get to ask the questions.
Yeah, that's okay. That's their right.
Do you think, though, that sometimes you may have taken back some of your thoughts? I'm thinking of the time that you happened to mention something to someone you thought was just an autograph seeker, I think, outside of a banquet. And
oh, no, I never take that back.
You said, let's tell people what you said. You said, I'm covering the worst president in American history. That would be Bush. The person you were speaking to turned out to be a writer, and your comments were published. And after that, you weren't called on at a press conference. And I understood that you wrote the president and apologized.
Pardon me? I never.
Never. Set the record straight on that.
That was another situation. I forget exactly what it was. I wrote him a note. But it had nothing to do with my saying he was the worst president.
Well, again, you know, continuing our look ahead with Obama, what do you anticipate his relationship with the press is going to be like?
I think that he plays his cards right in many ways. He's definitely trying to woo everybody. And let's just hope. He's coming in with great expectations, high hopes. Let's hope he lives up to his promises. He has promises to keep and miles to go.
And Helen Thomas to answer to.
Me and I hope the whole country.
Helen Thomas, a veteran member of the Washington Press Corps, who, as we said, has covered every American president since JFK and is looking forward to the Barack Obama administration. Helen, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, we'll be back in a minute with the role slaves played building the Capitol here and now. Welcome back. Barack Obama's swearing-in ceremony at the Capitol tomorrow will, of course, resonate for Black Americans. And, of course, he'll be mindful of those who labored to make his success possible, upon whose shoulders he stands. But tomorrow, he will quite literally be standing upon their labor. In the 1800s, slaves and free blacks alike built much of the nation's capital. Journalist Jesse Holland tells their story in his book, Black Men Built the Capitol, Discovering African-American History in and Around Washington, D.C. And Jesse joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with the Capitol building. This, of course, where the Senate and the House of Representatives work. You say it wouldn't exist as we know it today without slave labor.
That's correct. Out of the more than 600 people who worked on the Capitol, just about 400 were African-American slaves. And we know this because the federal government wrote receipts.
We know this, but you really underscore this point in your book. They paid the owners of the slaves, not the slaves.
That's correct. The only things the slave owners had to provide to the federal government was the slave and a blanket. And in return, they got the money for the labor of these slaves on the White House and the Capitol.
Well, in staying with the Capitol, you write there was an original dome on top of the Capitol that everyone thought was kind of dinky. And a new one was built in 1855 by a sculptor named Thomas Crawford. Now, you tell a story I hadn't heard before about what this white sculptor originally wanted to do on top of the Capitol.
He came up with a design that's very similar to the Statue of Freedom that sits on the top of the Capitol today. But he had placed what was called a liberty cap on top of the statue. And it's approved by everyone except the person in charge of the Capitol construction, the then Secretary of War, Jefferson Davis. And the reason why Jefferson Davis didn't approve this design is because the only people in Roman history who wore liberty caps were freed slaves. So what Thomas Crawford had originally planned to do was place a statue of a freed slave on top of the Capitol.
Right.
Now, Jefferson Davis goes on to become the president of the Confederacy. So he told Thomas Crawford that he either had to change it or he would give the commission to someone else. Well, Thomas Crawford does make a change, but the only change he makes is he takes that liberty cap off and places an American Eagle helmet on top of it.
Sort of a Roman helmet that we're familiar with now.
That's right.
You write about Philip Reed, a slave from South Carolina. Now, what was his role when it came to the Freedom Statue?
Well, Philip Reed is basically responsible for the Statue of Freedom being on top of the Capitol. Now, when Thomas Crawford finished his design of the Statue of Freedom, he made a life-size plaster model of this statue. And he disassembled it into five parts, put it on a ship with an Italian workman whose only job was to take it apart and put it back together, and he sends it to America. Well, the Italian workman puts the statue together in between the Capitol and the Supreme Court, and everybody comes from around Washington, and everyone goes, ooh, ah, what a wonderful statue. But it's at that point the Italian workman has an idea. He's the only person alive who knows how to take this plaster statue apart without breaking it. So he tells the federal government that he will refuse to take it back apart again unless they pay him more money. Well, Philip Reed's master, Clark Mills, had gotten the commission to bronze the Statue of Freedom. And he asked Philip Reed if he knew how to take it apart. And Philip Reed said yes. Without Philip Reed, that plaster model of the Statue of Freedom might still be sitting outside between the Capitol and the Supreme Court. He was also the person who was put in charge of bronzing the Statue of Freedom. Now, that's irony for you. An African-American slave is the person bronzing the Statue of Freedom that's going on top of the Capitol.
Well, you just won't look up at the Capitol dome the same way again after you hear that story. Or look at the National Mall the same way again. You write that America's front yard, this lawn that stretches out from the Capitol, was the best place in town to sell slaves. Describe what it looked like at that time.
This was the place where people could come down and they could sell their wares. People could also come down, and since they had so much space, farmers would even bring their cattle down to graze. Right in between where the Department of Education and the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum sits used to be a slave market called Roby's Tavern. Just a few blocks up from that, going back toward the Smithsonian African Art Museum, was another one called the Yellow House. Even the National Archives itself sits on top of what used to be a slave market.
You mentioned Roby's Market, and you found pretty brutal description of slaves who lived in the basement and were hauled up to be put on slave ships. And on the inaugural parade route, which goes along Pennsylvania Avenue, you write about the St. Charles Hotel, where slaves were kept in underground dungeons. And then there's the White House, which, of course, is now going to house the first black president. There's a lot of proof that slaves built the original White House that burned down in 1814, but no proof that slaves did the rebuilding, although you say there's a strong probability.
Slavery was still legal in Washington, D.C., and slaves were actually used and kept inside the White House itself. So it's probably a good possibility that slaves were used in the Reconstruction, but we haven't found the actual paperwork to prove that yet.
But interestingly, presidents who owned slaves, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Andrew Jackson, to name just a few, brought them to the White House, but you tell a story about Thomas Jefferson and James Hemings. This is the brother of Sally Hemings, and this is the one, at this point, former slave who didn't work in the White House.
That's right. Thomas Jefferson actually took James Hemings, who was a slave of Thomas Jefferson's, with him to Paris. So James Hemings was trained in French cuisine. Well, he comes back with Jefferson to America, and he becomes such a renowned chef, he is able to work outside of Jefferson's employ and raise money and buy his freedom. Thomas Jefferson goes on to become president, and he goes out and he contacts James Hemings and says, well, I know you're free now, but I want you to come back and work for me at the White House as the first White House chef. However, Hemings, and I suspect probably because Thomas Jefferson is still holding the rest of his family, including his sister Sally, in bondage, tells the president no.
Why don't we know more about this? I mean, you write in your preface that there were rumors about the role that blacks played in building the nation's capital. You even read about it in a Marvel comic.
Amazingly enough, yes.
Yeah, and that you know, started off doing your own research. But why aren't more Americans more aware of this?
If you look at the rebuilding of Ground Zero in New York, everyone can find pictures of the person who's designing the new Freedom Towers. Everyone can tell you who the architect and the designers are, but no one can tell you who the people are who are actually building the building. And it was even worse when you go back into the past. These people were slaves. The only reason why we even know that African Americans were used in these projects is because the government had to write receipts, like store receipts, for merchandise.
Yeah.
One of the great things that's been done so far is that Congress opened up its new Congressional Visitor Center, and they named the largest room in this visitor center Emancipation Hall. And they actually placed that plaster Statue of Freedom that was worked on by Philip Reed in the middle of this hall. So at least at the Capitol now, there's some recognition that African-American slaves worked on this building and some of the things that they did.
That's journalist Jesse Holland, author of Black Men Built the Capitol, Discovering African-American History in and Around Washington, D.C. And Jesse, before we let you go, I just want to ask, you know, as we all watch the inauguration, of course, we'll see the things we always see, the dignitaries sitting in the seats, we'll see the family stand, we'll watch the parade, we'll see the bands. What else will you be seeing?
I'll see a circle in history closing. You'll have an African-American man taking the oath of office for the most powerful office in the United States in front of a building that was built by some of the least powerful African-Americans in American history, African-American slaves.
It also, I just, in my mind's eye, after having read your book, I see their ghosts.
Right.
Yeah.
Hopefully, some of the descendants, even though we don't know who they are, hopefully some of the descendants of those slaves will be on the National Mall where they can see how far this country has come.
Jesse, thanks so much for painting that image for us.
Thank you. Keep on.